As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Sorry, I'm always kind of not used to when this thing gets going. Welcome to this live room. Thanks so much for being here. I see there's a bunch of you in here already. That's great. What a weird time to be following this Canadiens team. It's been a lot of the same up until now, but a three-game winning streak. Martin Saint-Louis is getting them to actually play hockey as a team that looks like they know what they're doing. So thought I would do this, jump on here and take some questions from you guys and just talk about what's going on. Obviously, there's the coaching change, trade deadlines coming up, the play of some of their younger guys. Just anything you guys want to talk about. Just thought it'd be a good chance, especially with the Canadiens off today, to give you guys a chance to ask a few questions. And obviously, as I mentioned on Twitter, I don't know how many of you saw it, but if you had any questions on sort of the Martin Saint-Louis piece that we did, Marc-Antoine Gaudet and I, that ran on the weekend, now's a good chance to get those questions in. So without further ado, I see some of you are already queued up for some questions. So let's get started. We're going to go till about 4 o'clock today, 4 Eastern, I should specify. So we got about an hour, so let's get to it. Let's start with Josh. Hang on. Josh, are you there?
Yeah, there. How are you guys going?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Just wondering, when Marty St. Louis was hired, I guess it was maybe 2 weeks ago at this point. He's kind of
not even
2 weeks ago, man. Yes. And we have a brand new team that we're watching. I was kind of the murmurs, at least on the Twitterverse, was that he was kind of there to be an eye for Gorton and Hughes, and then transition maybe to a front office job in the summer. It kind of seems like isn't going to be the course of action at all. I just wanted your take on that.
Yeah, sure. I think there was that impression at first. Whenever there's a management change, whoever's the coach at the time has to be feeling kind of queasy. People generally, like to have their own people in place. And this is part of the reason for it, because management and the coaching staff work together to evaluate players, to figure out what kind of players they need to provide for that coach. So it's normal that Martin St. Louis would come in and you know, provide that information or be part of that process. It's there's nothing groundbreaking to that. But, you know, talk to anyone who played with Martin St. Louis and you will hear them say how he's always wanted to do this. This has always been a goal of his, would be to come back to the NHL and coach. And he felt this way while he was playing. I mean, Vinny LeCavalier the other day, who obviously just got hired as a special advisor to hockey operations, mentioned that during their playing days, since Martin St. Louis always talked about wanting to be a coach, he joked that he would be his assistant coach one day. Of course, now it turns out he's actually above him in the org chart. But yeah, so I don't think there's any plan for Martin St. Louis to transition to a front office job at all. He's been pretty adamant that this is what he's wanted for a long time, that this is what he's been preparing for a long time. And honestly, if you listen to him talk about coaching, and again, you know, read the piece. I mean, honestly, like that piece was just us asking questions and Martin St. Louis just talking, and then Marc-Antoine and I basically writing down what he said and putting it out there. I mean, it's not that simple, but basically was. I mean, the stuff he said was so compelling because he's thought about this stuff for so long. And so coaching has been a goal of his. He kind of knew that this was going to happen. I don't think he knew it was going to happen in this way or this quickly, whether he would jump straight from coaching his son's Bantam team and his son's prep team right to an NHL job. In Montreal, no less, but this was the end game for him for a long time, ever since he was even a player. So I don't think anyone should expect Martin St. Louis to get bumped up to the front office. I don't think he would even want that. I mean, I think his goal is to prove himself till the end of the season and earn a full-time job by the end of the year. Juste un rappel que on peut aussi prendre des questions en français s'il y a du monde qui préfèrent demander leurs questions en français, on peut le faire en français aussi. So French or English for questions, we'll go to Marc-André next. Hello.
Salut, Alpin.
Salut.
Moi, j'aimerais amener un point par rapport à Ducharme que j'ai comme pas entendu nulle part parler. Ça se peut-tu? En tout cas, moi, je l'écoutais en conférence de presse en anglais. Je veux dire, j'ai le même accent que lui, là, en anglais, puis je comprenais absolument rien de ce qu'il disait. J'essayais d'imaginer comment qu'un Russe, un Finlandais, un Suédois pouvait comprendre son anglais, puis ça se peut-tu que ça soit un point sur le fait que personne n'avait l'air de rien comprendre de son système et blablabla?
Honnêtement, moi, j'ai jamais eu de la... Mais en tout cas, moi, je suis anglophone, alors peut-être que c'est plus facile pour moi, mais j'ai jamais eu de la misère à comprendre l'anglais. Merci pour la question, Marc-André. J'ai jamais eu de la misère à comprendre Dominique quand il parlait en anglais. En fait, j'ai trouvé que c'était un gars qui était très posé. C'était bien comme journaliste de demander une question puis avoir un coach qui réfléchit à son réponse avant de répondre. Mais j'avoue que sa façon de parler... C'était très délibéré, c'était un peu lent, c'était pas vraiment quelque chose qui paraît bien à la télé. Alors peut-être que son message passait un peu de la même façon dans le vestiaire, mais je pense pas. Écoute, c'est un coach qui a eu beaucoup de succès à tous les niveaux. Il était quand même entraîneur de l'équipe Canada junior. Ses joueurs l'ont vraiment apprécié. Je me rappelle une fois à Colorado, on attendait la disponibilité de Claude Julien, puis à un moment donné, Nathan MacKinnon s'est pointé en relis, puis essayait d'être discret, mais il ne savait pas quoi faire. Puis je me suis dit que je dis ah, j'imagine que tu es là pour Dominique. Il a dit oui, puis je l'ai pointé vers une porte à côté, puis les deux se sont jasés pendant longtemps avec Jonathan Drouin, entre autres, mais. Je pense pas qu'on devrait conclure nécessairement que Dominique Ducharme était nul comme coach. C'est pas vrai. C'est un bon coach, à mon avis. C'est juste qu'avec ce groupe de joueurs-là, je pense que c'est assez évident, rendu là, qu'il a perdu ce groupe-là, puis il a perdu la confiance des joueurs, puis il jouait plus pour lui. Alors, je pense que c'est aussi simple que ça, mais honnêtement, je pense pas que Je pense pas que le langage ou ça, c'est forcé en anglais a été un facteur. Je pense que c'est plutôt le message qu'il a envoyé, puis le fait que, à mon avis, le fait qu'il restait quand même assez rigide sur la façon de jouer, qui était pas efficace, puis c'était évident. Le fait qu'il voulait vraiment rien changer, je pense que c'est finalement ça a donné qu'il a perdu son poste. OK, on va aller, we'll go to Matthew. Hey, Matthew, you're up.
Hey, thanks for that. Quick question, it's mostly related towards goalies. I'm very curious as to who's going to be our tandem starting next year.
Ah, good question. I don't think anyone knows. It's, this is obviously a very tricky situation and very dependent on what happens with Carey Price. And I'm honestly not getting a good feeling on Carey Price right now. Listen, he's not skating again. When he spoke to the media about a month ago, I want to say, time is a flat circle right now, but it's, a little while ago, saying how the next few weeks were going to be very important in determining his immediate playing future. I don't want to say long-term future, but he did mention that they were reaching a critical point where they needed to see some sort of positive response from his knee. And then after a week of skating or so, he was suddenly not skating anymore. Canadians kind of insisted to say that it wasn't a setback, but it's hard to kind of see it otherwise. And so, so that's why there's no good answer to your question. I think in an ideal world, Carey Price would come back at some point this season, play 10 or 15 games, show that he can still play at a Carey Price level, and maybe entice a team out there that he would be willing to go to, and a team that would be able to absorb at least a good chunk of his contract, and a team that could come to terms with the Canadians on what the Canadians deem to be fair value for him, and find him a place where he can play and win. I think all parties involved would rather have it happen that way. But the reality is that none of the parties involved can foresee that happening until Carey Price gets back on the ice on a consistent basis and shows he's physically able to play this position. I mean, the one thing people have to realize, like if you've never stood next to Carey Price, he's a large man. He's a man with, and the way he plays the position, that explosiveness from side to side that made him so successful, also puts a ton of strain on his joints, on his knees, and on his hips, and that adds up. And so, I hope he can get back. I really hope he gets a shot at proving to the league that he's worth trading for. And I think, but until that question is answered, we can't know who's going to be the goaltending tandem next year. But having a tandem formed around Jake Allen, maybe a younger goaltender, maybe that they pick up either in free agency or by a trade or what have you, would be far from a disaster. In fact, I think in an ideal world, the Canadians would already start, planning the future in net. Is Caden Primo part of that future? We'll have to see. Obviously, what happened this season for him was very far from ideal, but I don't think it would be right to give up on him as a goaltending prospect just yet. But I think it's also fair to say that the Canadians need a sort of contingency plan if he doesn't work out. They have a couple of goalies in the system that are far from being ready to even take a shot at playing in the NHL. So maybe acquiring one in the offseason would be the way to go, regardless of whether they're able to trade Carey Price or not. Next up, let's go to Alex.
Hey, Sharpen, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Good. I wanted your opinion on whether, at this point in the season, like given our recent successes, I mean, to me they're bitter and sweet. My question is, should you be trading players that are clearly coveted by other teams, like let's say Lehkonen or Chiara? Like, let's say maybe the price that the other teams gave you wasn't exactly what you were looking for. or yet, but let's say a first round pick is already on the table and you're holding out because it's like you want hypothetically an extra fourth round pick. But given that as a manager, you should probably try to kind of like make the most out of this last season and get a higher draft pick. Should you just accept maybe that you can trade him now and have better results relative to how your team is performing? And then also like not risk an injury to the player, because let's not forget, if the player is injured, you're not getting anything at all. So like, to what extent should you lower the price? And I'm not saying this because like I don't want the team to win at all. Like I'm really happy to see Caulfield perform, but I think it's not helping the team in the long term. And believe me, like in 2019, when on the 14th pick, when they announced it would be from the U.S. National Development Program, I almost cried until they said Cam York instead of Cole Caulfield. But I really do want that draft pick.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. A couple of things there. First of all, I don't know if you read my piece from last night, but in all realistic probabilities here, the Canadians would have to go on a pretty extraordinary run from now to the end of the season to fall out of the top three. You know, I think, sure, they could easily pass the Coyotes if they continue playing like this. But, you know, I figured it out last night. If the Kraken maintain their current pace, they'll finish with 58 points. So for the Canadians to pass them in the standings, they would have to play like 480 hockey, which I guess is not impossible. It doesn't seem very likely compared, you know, based on how they've played all season. And eventually the new coach bump wears off. Like just watch, look at the Canucks, you know? And so it happens, you know, like every team goes through a little bump when a new coach arrives, especially someone as unique as Martin St-Louis. Eventually that wears off and you kind of come back and settle into who you are as a team. And I think it's pretty well established who this team is. But let's say they play for 500 for the rest of the year. It's not inconceivable. So then maybe they would pass the Kraken and finish, you know, 29th or 30th, I should say, which still puts them in the top three spot in terms of draft lottery odds. And, you know, catching the New Jersey Devils, who are currently in 29th, would take a really extra, they would have to play 580 hockey for the next rest of the season, assuming the Devils maintain their current pace. So getting a few wins, the benefits of getting some wins, I think far outweigh the downside of hurting your draft odds. If you look, I think it's over the last 11 years, I think the worst team in the league only won the lottery twice. Buffalo wound up with the top pick last year because Seattle actually won the lottery, but they weren't allowed to pick first overall as an expansion team. So it's really quite rare that the team with the best odds wins the lottery. So to do the damage that was being done, in my opinion, with not only the losses, but the way they were losing, they were not competitive in games at all. So these players need to feel something good out of this season. And listen, if the Canadians play 500 the rest of the year and they happen to catch Seattle and finish in 30th, I don't think it's the end of the world. I think it's actually probably a good thing over the long term. And yes, their draft odds get hurt slightly, but it's really not that significant. And they would still have a top three pick. And right now, frankly, the way the draft is playing out, you know, the gap between Shane Wright and the field has narrowed significantly. So who even knows if you're getting the best player at number one overall, assuming number one overall becomes Shane Wright. So there's so many unknowns. And I think right now in the here and now, it'd be worth just doing what's best for the development of the players that they have and the players that they know are going to be here for the long term. So when you watch a guy like Ryan Poehling playing the way he has, you know, that should be encouraging. Obviously, you mentioned Caulfield, Suzuki producing more. I mean, even Anderson, who I know there's his name's floating around in trade rumors. I'd be really surprised if they traded him. And you know, you heard Martin St. Louis say before the game that that's a line that he thinks could be a line for a long time, for many years maybe. So, you know, there are a bunch of players on this team who will not only be on the team next year, but will still be on the team whenever they come out of whatever it is that they plan on doing here, but this transition period. and you don't want to overly damage those players, just to improve your odds by like 6 percentage points or whatever it is. I don't have the lottery odds in front of me, but the difference between first and second and third in terms of lottery odds is not all that huge. You know, the league has set it up this way to discourage tanking, and frankly have been successful because tanking is not proven to be an efficient way of getting the number one overall pick, especially since they changed the draft lottery rules. So I wouldn't get too hung up on wins being a bad thing. I think right now wins are probably more of a good thing than a bad thing.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, let's go to Stefan.
All right. Hi, Arpin.
Hey, Stefan, how are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. So the statement from Martin Saint-Louis that really first drew my attention in the Hockey IQ podcast interview he gave was, I'm paraphrasing now, but I think what he said was, what I was really elite at as a player was getting better.
Was getting better, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that was a great line, yeah.
I love it. I mean, that's in the psychology of learning, we call that the growth mindset. It's fantastic. And also, I'm noticing that many players are using similar language in their post-game pressers. They keep talking about getting better, improving, and so on. And they really seem to have latched onto this line of thinking. Now, mm-hmm. in your piece, you refer to the fact that Martin Saint-Louis considers that hockey IQ is also a skill you can work on and improve. So what kind of impact do you think this will have on the way the Habs leadership will think about roster players, prospects, and even pro scouting, amateur scouting, and so on?
That's a good question. I thought of this myself, actually. Thanks for the question, Stefan.
Sure.
It's interesting because, you know, hockey IQ is something that amateur scouts put a lot of emphasis on. And frankly, under Trevor Timmins, that's what the Canadians have put an emphasis on in a big way in the draft. You know, I mean, it's really something that they look at and really try to identify because of this assumption that hockey IQ is something that can't be taught. If Martin Saint-Louis is right and that it can be taught over time through video, through chalkboard talk, through just exposure to different theories and different ways of looking at the game, if it can be developed, then does it allow you to sort of shift your scouting strategy towards just emphasizing pure skill? And if a guy's kind of lacking in hockey IQ, while under normal circumstances that might bring him down a notch, maybe in their eyes, it doesn't, because they'll say, okay, we'll bring him in and then he'll kind of develop his hockey IQ with us. I personally don't think that's going to happen. You know, when I think of hockey IQ, the guy that jumps out to me is Alex Galchenyuk in a big way. It's super skilled, work ethic through the roof. I mean, this guy was out before practice, after practice, every day working on his skills. Had all the tools in the world to be a successful hockey player. It's just the hockey IQ that wasn't there, and it never really came. I mean, honestly, like, you know, not to pick on that one play, but that pass in, I guess it was game five of the Leafs series that led to the 2-on-0 with Caulfield and Suzuki, like, that's Alex Galchenyuk in a nutshell, you know? I mean, it's just, so you know, I don't know to what extent they'll be able to discount Hockey IQ in their evaluation on the amateur and pro side. And it should be, you should want to get players that have a certain base level of it. But what I find super interesting and a game changer of sorts is if Martin St. Louis is able to actually improve players' hockey IQ over time through teaching and what have you, it's really going to make this team a lot better. But you know, I wouldn't bank on that as management and as scouts being the case. You know, you can't just say, okay, well, that guy doesn't have much hockey IQ. Let's take him anyway, and then Marty will just fix it. You know, like, I don't think that's the way to do it either. But in later rounds, like, I wouldn't do that at the top of the draft, but maybe in later rounds, a guy who's slipping because he has that one deficiency, maybe you do take a chance on him and say, well, maybe we can teach him this. Maybe we can work on it. So I thought about the same thing, Stefan, and it's a fair question. I personally wouldn't let it adjust, or I wouldn't let it impact my evaluation of players until there's actual proof that it can be done and that we actually see the results of it on the ice. Because up until now, the prevailing wisdom on Hockey IQ is that it can't be taught. I don't agree with that. I kind of agree with the way Martin St. Louis sees it, but I personally don't know how you teach Hockey IQ. He certainly has ideas. So let's see if that can be proven true. And if so, then maybe a few years down the line, they could start to sort of readjust how they look at things. But for now, I don't think it's going to have much impact. Let's go to Harris is up next. Harris?
Yeah.
Am I saying that?
Harris. Yeah, Harris.
Oh, yeah, you were here last time. Yeah, hey, Harris. Hello.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Arpin. I had a couple of questions about a couple of different players as we approach the trade deadline. I was at the game last night, and the hit on Muzzin was pretty gruesome. Yes. And Kripios just tweeted a half hour ago that he's out indefinitely, especially as he came back from a concussion earlier in the season. Do you think that kind of pushes the Leafs to the top of the list for Sherratt? Second was RDS reported that the Canadiens asked the Capitals about Samsonov. What do you think of that?
Okay, thanks, Harris. Yes. Well, I think even before Jake Muzzin getting hurt, Sherratt is someone that would have interested them just because, frankly, Muzzin's really not had a good season. That was a really horrific thing that we saw last night. You hate seeing someone's head get slammed off the ice like that. Kind of watching him lying on the ice kind of reminded me of George Parros when that happened to him, when he had that fight with Colton Orr against the Leafs again, and how he was lying totally motionless. But so maybe that pushes the Leafs, but, you know, quite honestly, they were already in the market for a defenseman. They were already in the market for someone to kind of mitigate the difficult season Jake Muzzin was already having. If he's flat out not available, then yeah, it would push the priority higher for them, I would imagine. But they were already in the mix. I mean, they were already a potential destination for Sherratt. If there's one team who understands the difference between playoff Sherratt and regular season Sherratt, I would like to say it's probably the Toronto Maple Leafs. And you know, this is another thing, like, just while we're on this topic, but, you know, you look at Sherratt's metrics and you do like an objective evaluation of him as a regular season player. And yes, it looks like he's not a very good player and that, frankly, you shouldn't be spending massive assets to get him. But there is a big difference between a playoff series and the regular season. When you face the same team over and over again, certain players become increasingly effective the more they're exposed to the same players. I mean, just ask Jake Muzzin about Josh Anderson. You know, I feel like, well, I don't know if Jake Muzzin would actually admit it, but Jake Muzzin was sick of Josh Anderson by like game three of that series last year. Like, he was getting rid of pucks. If he knew Josh Anderson was on the ice, the puck wasn't on Jake Muzzin's stick very long because he knew Anderson was coming to nail him. And so that's why certain players are just more valuable in that environment. I think Ben Sherratt is one of those guys, and he's proven it in back-to-back years, frankly. I mean, the Canadiens didn't go very far in the bubble playoffs. They didn't go anywhere in the bubble playoffs, actually. They just won a play-in round. Ben Chiarot was very effective in that round because he's going to see the same matchups over and over again over a 7-game series. And as that series goes along, he becomes more and more of a factor because players adjust the way they play when a guy like him is on the ice. On the Samsonov thing, yeah, I saw that. It's interesting, and it kind of goes back to the earlier question about the goaltending tandem next year and the need to bring in a young goaltender that can grow. I don't really know how that trade would work. It would obviously need to involve a player with term. It would be more of a hockey trade than the traditional deadline trade. But yeah, it's, you know, I feel it makes sense. You know, there's definitely a gap in the Canadiens' goaltending pipeline between the NHL goaltenders and the ones that are coming that are already in the system. There is a gap there, and Sam Montembeau is right in that gap. And honestly, the way he's playing, I'm kind of rooting for him to keep playing the way he has. He's never really done it on a consistent basis, but now he's strung together a few good games in a row. He's still pretty young, a big goalie. So maybe he can be that guy. But I think the fact that that gap exists would be a good explanation as to why the Canadiens would at least inquire as to Samsonov's availability. Okay, let's go to Andrew. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. So when St. Louis was first hired, I think a lot of the logic we heard was that, you know, the best new blood type candidates wouldn't be available until the offseason, so he'd be a placeholder and then part of the hiring process in the offseason. People like Benoit Gloux at the Tampa affiliate, Joel Bouchard, Pascal Vincent, Alain Nasreddine, those sorts of people. All of whom are well thought of and have more experience than St. Louis. But today it seems like St. Louis is going to be a shoo-in for the job if the Habs play at like a 400 points percentage for the rest of the year, which is way below what expectations were at the beginning of the season and might not show anything about him being a great coach, just a breath of fresh air. So was it a mistake, do you think, to get him involved so quickly instead of just using a real interim coach like Richardson or Burrows to the exclusion of these other candidates?
No. I think that's a fair question, Andrew. But I guess my first response would be that they didn't really have an ideal interim coach. Like, they needed to change the direction the team was going in the very short term. And I think putting Luke Richardson as coach was a bit of a non-starter for the organization. I think Jeff Molson still has battle scars from when Randy Cunningworth was brought in to coach the team very early in his tenure as owner of the Canadiens, and did not want to go down that road again with a unilingual Anglophone coach. Alex Burrows, I guess, would have been an option. But really, if, you know, this was something that was on the minds, I think, of Jeff Gordon and Kent Hughes as a possibility for next season. So why not bring in Martin St-Louis and see if he can do it? Like, listen, and I don't think that book's been written yet. I mean, yeah, he's got a good first 10 or 12 days or whatever it's been. But the team is playing much, much better. But as I mentioned earlier, a new coach bump is hardly rocket science. It's just the reality of what happens in the NHL when you have a new voice with new ideas, presenting information in a different way, leaning on different players, giving players confidence. There's always a little bump, and how long that bump lasts varies from team to team. But Martin St. Louis is going to go through some difficult times. They're going to go on losing streaks again. I mean, it's inevitable. It's pretty much guaranteed that at some point he's going to hit a rough patch, and we're going to, and you know, he said it last night. I thought it was a great, you know, he was talking about Cole Caulfield. He was talking about smaller players. He was asked, Duke Cowan of the Gazette asked him about what he would say to smaller kids who hope to reach the NHL. And he said, and it was a great line, he said, embrace the struggle, because it is in struggle that you show who you are and that you show real development and growth. So embrace that. And as the smaller player, you're going to face struggles. Well, him as a coach, like, this could easily apply to him as a coach, and it could apply to their entire team and their entire organization for that matter. is they're currently going through a struggle and they need to embrace it as a development moment and see how they could take advantage of it. But he himself is a coach who has not experienced a struggle per se, where he's under pressure and he's getting criticized in public and the team's not responding to what he's saying and they're losing. And he has not experienced that yet. So we can't do, I don't think a proper evaluation of how Martin St. Louis is as a coach can be done until he experiences that, as he himself said. And I think as he himself probably realizes, like, he knows, he has to know that this is his grace period. He's going to get a moment, a period of time where he's going to be given the benefit of the doubt, where, you know, maybe some of his missteps will be overlooked because he's new, because he's refreshing, and just because of what a disaster this season had been until his arrival. But, you know, that wears off at some point. So we're going to see when we reach that point how he handles it. I personally, the one thing that really comes across from this guy is just how confident he is in himself. And so far, he's had no reason not to be, but he doesn't strike me as a guy whose confidence would easily be shaken. But, you know, his real test is going to come in those moments where he has reason to question himself, where he has reason to second guess himself. And so we're not even close to being there yet. So, you know, that's why I think that this arrangement is the best arrangement, because the Canadians, you know, Ken Hughes and Jeff Gorton, they can't be 100% sure that he's ready to do this. And if he shows over the course of the next couple of months that maybe he's not quite ready for this, which is possible, like, just try and, like, remove yourself from the current context and foresee a time in the season where things aren't going that well and his decisions start to become a little more questionable. They're going to see his true colors as a coach, and it'll give them the opportunity to have a cold evaluation and really compare what they have in Martin St. Louis and what someone like Pascal Vincent or Ali Nasruddin or any other number of candidates could bring in that position, guys who have paid their dues and are ready to take the next step to a head coaching position and do a proper evaluation that way. But it's clear that this is, in many ways, Martin St. Louis' job to lose, either the Canadians deciding that he shouldn't be the guy or he himself deciding that maybe this isn't for him, which I really would be quite surprised if he came to that conclusion. But, you know, again, that book hasn't been written. It's a fair point. But let's just wait and see what happens here before we start fully evaluating what Martin St. Louis brings as a coach, because these are very early days and I've never seen a coach come in other than Cunningworth, I should say. But I've never seen a coach come in and just start getting ripped to shreds 2 weeks into their tenure. There's always a period where everything he touches turns to gold and that everyone's praising him. And this is where Martin St. Louis is right now. So let's see what happens when the struggle comes, which it inevitably will at some point. All right, we're going to go to Charles? Or Charles? Bonjour. Salut, Charles.
Ça va bien?
Oui, ça va, merci.
Oui, bon, j'ai vraiment aimé ce que Marc Bergevin a fait pendant qu'il était à Montréal, mais dans ce qui est entré en vigueur cette année, il y a les contrats de Petrie, de Gallagher, Armia, Hoffman, le contrat de Duchamp, la perte de Kotkaniemi, de Dano, l'échange de Dvorak. Sachant tout ça, selon toi, dans 20 ans, quand on va se rappeler de Marc Bergevin, est-ce qu'on va plus se rappeler du parcours en série jusqu'à la finale de la Coupe Stanley ou bien, tu sais, de la déchéance qui est en train de se produire cette année?
Bonne question. En fait, honnêtement, Charles, j'ai pensé un peu, tu sais, tout de suite après son congédiement, j'ai pensé, tu sais, ça va être quoi son héritage avec le Canadien? Ça va être quoi? Comment est-ce qu'il va se faire? Puis c'est difficile de pas croire que, effectivement, le parcours jusqu'en finale de la Coupe Stanley l'année passée, ça va être son héritage. Tu sais, ils se sont rendus le plus proche qu'une équipe du Canadien s'est rendue depuis 93. Puis honnêtement, il a bâti cette équipe-là avec les séries en tête. T'sais, il savait que le contrat de Dano venait à échéance, Petrie, Gallagher aussi, avant qu'il re-signe. C'était vraiment une année qui a été ciblée par l'administration de Bergevin. Depuis longtemps, c'était l'année où l'équipe, il fallait qu'il soit compétitif cette année-là. Juste à cause de toutes les circonstances, mais tout s'alignait pour que l'été qu'on vient d'avoir ou l'entre-saison qu'on vient d'avoir était supposé être une entre-saison de transition où l'équipe commençait à se rajeunir, commençait à peut-être connaître un peu de difficultés, pas autant que cette saison, j'avoue, mais commençait à connaître un peu de difficultés pour effectivement avoir une autre mini-reset, si tu veux, puis tourner l'équipe vers les Suzuki, les Kokinimi et toutes les autres jeunes qui ont repêché depuis 3-4 ans. Mais c'est ça que je trouve dommage un peu, c'est que malgré le fait que Marc Bergevin savait très bien que cette saison qu'on est en train de vivre en ce moment, il savait depuis des années que cette saison-là allait être un peu difficile. Et il savait depuis des années qu'il voulait que l'équipe de 2020-21, il fallait que cette équipe-là soit compétitive. Alors, il a réussi la première partie. Il a bâti une équipe qui est quand même qui a eu un chemin en série éliminatoire comme prévu. Dans le fond, comme Marc Bergevin lui-même a prévu, tu sais, il est allé chercher Edmondson et Perry et tout ce monde-là, même Star, avec les séries en vue. Il savait qu'il serait peut-être pas les meilleurs joueurs en saison régulière, mais rendu en série, il serait bon. Mais malgré ça, malgré que tout ça a été prévu d'avance, il me semble qu'il a quand même laissé le parcours jusqu'en finale influencer ce qu'il a fait pendant l'entre-saison. Tu sais, c'est comme, à certains points, il voulait garder le momentum, mais il aurait juste dû accepter ce qu'il avait déjà établi, je pense, comme étant la réalité de cette équipe-là, que cette saison-là allait être une saison de transition. Et je pense qu'il a perdu ça de vue un peu. Puis je pense que, tu sais, la blessure à Weber, tout ce qui s'est passé dans l'entre-saison, tu sais, le repêchage, le désastre qui est arrivé au repêchage, tout ça a comme, tu sais, a rendu que Marc Bergevin était peut-être pas dans la meilleure position de prendre des décisions éclairées, puis il a connu un mauvais entre-saison. Honnêtement, je pense, moi, en tout cas, moi, je n'avais pas prévu que les Hurricanes allaient faire une offre hostile pour Jesperi Kotkaniemi. Je pense que c'est un peu derrière la décision de laisser Philippe Dano aller, c'est que Kotkaniemi allait être une partie de l'avenir de l'équipe. Puis il voyait mal avoir Suzuki, Kotkaniemi et Dano, particulièrement si Dano gagnait 6 millions par année ou whatever. Alors, tu sais, il y avait des circonstances qui étaient hors de son contrôle, mais je pense que c'était difficile à regarder l'entre-saison du Canadien et pas croire que c'était vraiment un désastre ou en tout cas, c'était mauvais. Alors, pour répondre aux questions, je pense que la finale de la Coupe Stanley va être l'héritage de Marc Bergevin. On va penser à ça, il va avoir 20 ans, je veux dire. Mais c'est non seulement le parcours, mais l'après de la finale qu'on va aussi se rappeler. Et honnêtement, c'est Kent Hughes et Jeff Corton, ils ont ça entre leurs mains. À quel point l'entre-saison qu'on vient de voir devient important dans l'histoire du Canadien. Ça va beaucoup dépendre sur l'efficacité, la rapidité avec laquelle ces deux hommes-là vont être capables de remettre le train sur les rails ou n'importe quelle expression que tu veux utiliser là, mais le plus rapidement qu'ils sont capables de le faire, le moins, je pense que dans 20 ans, on va se rappeler de l'entre-saison après la finale comme étant quelque chose qui a vraiment coûté le Canadien 4, 5, 6 ans de compétitivité ou d'avoir une bonne équipe.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, we're going to go to Alex again, I think. Alex?
Hey, Arpin. First things first, thanks for your answer earlier. I think it was, you mapped it out and it was pretty interesting. So I guess we'll see what happens the rest of the season, but I like the answer.
Okay.
Cool. I actually have two questions I find really interesting, and I think you'll like them. So the first one is Toffoli. So you know Toffoli was traded, and I wanted to know, in your opinion, to what extent was this trade like made because Gorton and Hughes prefer speed? Like, that's the kind of game they want to play, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But even though Toffoli wasn't like the fastest player, like, you can't really deny that he was a very productive player. So that's my first question. And the second one is relative to Hughes's press conference. I think he stated that despite trading Toffoli, he would still try to kind of find leadership. And it is by no means his goal to kind of aim for a first or second overall next year. At least, like, it's not in the cardboards. So what are your expectations for the Habs, knowing that they traded Toffoli, which is like clearly an indication of a rebuild, but at the same time, they're not rebuilding for next season? So those are my two questions.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. It's kind of, they kind of go sort of into the same question. So here's my thing. I personally, and you know, Nick Suzuki was asked this flat out, if he feels that the trade of Toffoli clearly shows that they're in a rebuild. And he just said, yep. And I don't blame him for thinking that. Toffoli is a very good player. They traded him for nothing, basically, for futures, for future assets that are not going to help this team for another 2 or 3 years at a minimum. So I don't blame the players for thinking that way. The whole thing with me is that, you know, rebuilds mean different things to different people. And in this market, and in hockey in general, frankly, people hear the word rebuild. And, you know, I think the famous, Brendan Shanahan line, or was it Mike Babcock? I think Mike Babcock, when he was hired, saying, you know, there will be pain, like, you're get ready for pain. You know, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be that. So yes, I guess the Canadiens are in a rebuild in the sense that they're trying to build back a competitive team, or rebuild a competitive team. But I think Ken Hughes has been very clear that they're not tearing this thing down to the studs. They're going to do something that I think is more akin to a reset than a rebuild, because they're not trading away every veteran player. They're not going to go scorched earth the way the Coyotes have. I mean, he could not have been clearer on this point. He mentioned the Coyotes by name numerous times when Marc-Antoine and I spoke to him a few weeks ago, saying that that's not what they're going to do. They're not going to do what the Sabres did. And you know, when you enter into a rebuild, the problem with going the full scorched earth rebuild route is that there's never an easy exit strategy. And you could argue that the Buffalo Sabres have never found a way out of their rebuild mode. They're still in it years after the fact. Edmonton's somehow still kind of in turmoil. They have a competitive team, but I don't think that rebuild has gone the way that they wanted either. And they've basically, you know, the number one overall picks they got, they have the best player in the world. They have two of the top five players in the world. You could even argue top three. And it has not gone smoothly for them. So I don't think that this management team buys into the notion that, you know, you have to go full on scorched earth rebuild. And I don't think that's what they're doing. The Toffoli trade, to get back to the other part of your question, as being a reflection of their desire for speed, I also don't know if that really holds true, because yes, Toffoli is not a particularly fast skater, but he is a fast thinker. He's a good decision maker. He's someone who plays with his brain. And he's someone who, frankly, would have probably really thrived under a guy like Martin St-Louis, who also played with his brain and who also wants his players to play with their brains. And he was very good at that. He's a guy who he knew what he was going to do with the puck before he got it, as Martin St-Louis wants all of his players to do. So I really don't think, yes, Toffoli lacks a certain amount of foot speed, but that doesn't prevent him from playing the game fast. Because playing the game fast doesn't necessarily mean fast skating. It means fast thinking more than fast skating, in my opinion. And I think in the opinion of a lot of people, when they say playing fast, which is, and sorry to harp on it, you know, I hope Alex Galchenyuk's not on this call, but to go back to Alex Galchenyuk, that is something the Canadians had a problem with, was that he had excellent speed. He was a very good skater. He was a fast skater, but he could not play fast. And there's a difference there. And what the Canadians are emphasizing is the ability to play fast. So trading Tyler Toffoli was not an indictment of his lack of foot speed. In fact, he plays the game fast. He plays the game at your desired speed because his processor in his brain is able to process information in a manner that he makes the right decision more often than not. And I remember Marc Bergevin had a great line about him last season when he said, the puck always winds up in a better place after it leaves his stick, or something to that effect. That's a paraphrase. But that basically he said, when Tyler Toffoli gets the puck and when he gets rid of the puck, it's always in a better place than when it started. And so, which just is another way of saying that Tyler Toffoli makes good decisions with the puck. And so in that sense, I think Martin St-Louis surely recognized it. Hughes, Gorton, you know, it was easy to see ever since Toffoli came back from his injury that that's what he does. And that's actually what was so striking about his start of the year, when he was really unrecognizably bad over the first couple of months. I mean, the whole team was, but he was really feeling the effects of that short offseason, because in my opinion, and my own theory, is that that short offseason didn't give his brain enough time to recover. And he wasn't as smart a hockey player. He wasn't making those good decisions. He was making bad decisions, kind of like we've seen Jeff Petrie make all season. Like, Jeff Petrie's skills haven't eroded. He's still an extremely fast player, and he's been obviously playing better of late. But most of the season, what's weird about him is that his brain has gone to mush, and he's not making good decisions on the ice, which is weird, because as a player ages, especially defensemen, what allows them to stay in the league is, as their physical skills deteriorate, their mental skills improve, and they're able to compensate for that deterioration with the improvement of their decision-making. Jeff Petrie's physical skills have not deteriorated. He's still just as good of a skater. He's still able to make passes, but his decision-making has made it so that those passes are, he's not passing it to the right player at the right time, and so they turn into bad passes. He's not shooting at the right time, and so those turn into bad shots. He's making poor decisions in the defensive zone. And I think we've seen over the last few games, Jeff Petrie's far from perfect, but his play is vastly improved because his brain is working at an optimal level again. But thanks for the question again, Alex. We got about 10 minutes left. There's one caller left. Ben, we're getting to you. So if anyone wants to get a question in, now would be the time to queue up. But Ben, you are next. Hello, Ben.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. So yeah, you can go like how much detail or whatever you want. I was just like wondering, could you just like name like the players on the Habs roster like that you think will be traded, and just like maybe like a prediction where they'll end up, and just like what a return might look like?
Yeah, sure. I can try that. You're really setting me up for.
Yeah.
Someone's going to record this, and I'm going to have to live this down.
Yeah, your prediction. Yeah, yeah.
That's okay. Yeah, well, let's see. I think thanks, Ben, for the question. I'm going to regret this. Ben Sherratt's the obvious one. I really do think Florida's really big on him. They don't have a cap issue, so they can actually jump the market and do it a little earlier than some of the other teams that are in consideration for him can. It's just a question of whether they want to give up the assets required. But I'm going to go Ben Sherratt, Florida. I think that's a fit. That's a really, really good team. Who probably needs some of the elements that Ben Sherratt brings. Having a defense with Ben Sherratt and Radko Gudas might not be great in the regular season, but in the playoffs, that would be a real pain in the ass to play against. So it's, you know, I think Florida's the landing spot for Ben Chiarot. I think he's going to bring back a first round pick and a later round pick, or sort of a marginal prospect. But I think in the Canadians' ideal world, they would be getting a first round worthy prospect for Ben Chiarot, who was drafted last year, 2 years ago, someone who's closer to helping the NHL team. But I think it's going to be difficult for them to do that. And I think we saw that in the Tyler Toffoli trade. I think all things being equal, instead of the first round pick they got, they would have gladly taken Jacob Pelche, Connor Zary, Dustin Wolf, even the young goaltender, to go back to the opening question. But Calgary is just not willing to do that. And I think a lot of teams are, you know, a draft pick is magic beans. You know, you don't know what it's going to become. Your prospect is your prospect, and you know the player, and you have a certain projection for them. It's a lot harder to get teams to let go of their former first round picks that they know and that they like their development since they've been drafted. So I think Ben Chiarot's going to go probably get a first round pick and either a later round pick or a more marginal sort of depth prospect. Otherwise, you know, I think Arturi Lehkonen is going to be traded. There's been a lot of whispers about the Rangers. It makes a lot of sense to me. He's a player who can play up and down the lineup. Jeff Gorton knows that pipeline better than any other team, obviously. They just hired the former director of European scouting of the Rangers. And so, you know, maybe a deal around Kravtsov. I don't know if the Rangers would be willing to do that. But frankly, if they can get a player like Lehkonen in, Lehkonen is such a valuable player to a playoff team. And it's really, he's just a walking intangible, that guy. I mean, and he's never played poorly in the playoffs. So, you know, I think either a first round pick back for him or a first round worthy prospect. And I think, you know, something centered around Kravtsov makes a lot of sense. And that could just be a one for one deal too, because if they can get Kravtsov over here, it's a pretty high level talent. And I think Kravtsov would appreciate the opportunity to jump straight to the NHL, which is what happened in a scenario like that. I'm going to leave it at that, Ben, just because I feel like I'm digging myself a hole that I'm going to regret, but those are my two that I'm going to stick with. So I'm going to guess Chiarot to the Panthers, Lehkonen to the Rangers. We'll see what else shakes out, but you know, I think Brett Kulak's probably going to be traded. God knows who's going to trade for him, but that's not a major trade. Anyone looking for any depth on defense, he's a very useful defenseman in my eyes. You could do far worse than having Brett Kulak as your number six. And if Mathieu Perreault comes back and is able to get a few games in before the deadline, he's probably a candidate to be traded as well, because he's versatile. He can play center, he can play wing. So the Canadiens would probably get a couple of later round picks in trades like with those two guys. Okay, Kyle?
I was just thinking about the D prospects, and I find, I guess because of the terrible season that's been happening, I feel as though people are kind of down on where we are in terms of we still have, you know, looking at the Athletic, like the eighth best prospect pool. And if you look at D, I'm just curious about, like, where do you see us doing with our D? Because when you kind of line it up, you've got Romanov, Mayu, Gouley, Harris, Struble, Norlander. So do you think that's viable going forward, or do you see them moving out some pieces? Because I don't think they would be playing all top six at the same time. So how do you think they're going to move in that direction? And where do you think the next draft pick would probably be? Probably up front, I would have believed, but just want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, sure, Kyle. This is actually a good opportunity for me. Thanks for the question. This is a good opportunity for me. I have been working for months on a profile of Caden Gouley. I spent a week following him around in Edmonton and Red Deer and Prince Albert, and tons of things have happened in the Canadiens world. Me and my entire family caught COVID in the interim, so I haven't finished it yet, and it's coming, I promise. But the one thing about Gouley that I can tell you is he's already basically a pro. Like he plays a pro game, and he will, in my opinion, is NHL ready. Like I can't see a scenario under which that Caden Gouley is not playing in Montreal next year. I mean, that's maybe a bit strong. He could come and have a terrible camp and get sent to Laval. That's a possibility. But the way he plays, The way he thinks the game, especially as a defenseman playing a defensive game, and how he attacks guys in the neutral zone, denies entries, extremely mobile, and just a punishing hitter. It's really hard for me to envision the Canadians not having Caden Gooley on their team next year. So that's one thing. And frankly, the guy he reminds me, like he's basically in my mind, he's kind of a bigger, more mobile Alex Romanov. Same limitations in the sense that, you know, it's not really quite clear what Romanov's offensive potential is. It's also kind of equally unclear what Gooley's offensive potential is. There's probably not a whole lot there, but plays a very similar game, except just kind of has slightly better tools than Romanov does. And Romanov's tools are pretty darn good. Like he's a plus skater in my books. Well, Gooley's like a plus skater, and he's big. He's big and he's mean. And so, but actually a super nice guy. Like he's mean on the ice. With Mayu, obviously Mayu is a very complicated situation, but you know, the way he's playing in London is beyond expectations, I think. Well, maybe not the Canadians' expectations, but he is exceeding expectations in London this season. He's currently injured. He's got like an ankle injury. It's relatively minor, but he's been fantastic. And so under normal circumstances, notwithstanding all the other stuff with him, he would also be a candidate to be in Montreal next season. Right shot D that the Canadians don't have much of in the pipeline. But obviously that's something the Canadians are going to have to manage from a communication standpoint, from a community outreach standpoint. There's a lot of things that they need to do to make that a possibility. There are a lot of steps that need to be taken for them to kind of lay the groundwork for him to come to Montreal. And it's unclear right now how they would do that. But from a hockey perspective, he's a very, very interesting prospect and is having a very good, you know, half season here. Because remember, he wasn't allowed to play before January 1st. So promising talent. Obviously, a lot of work needs to be done before he can be considered a candidate to be in Montreal. But just based on how he's played with London so far, very, very promising defense talent. That's what I think your group of defensemen that you listed is kind of tiered off. Jordan Harris would be in that tier as well in terms of being close to being NHL ready. And I think if all goes well, we'll probably see Jordan Harris in Montreal by the end of the season, you know, assuming he wants to sign with the Canadians, and frankly, having Hughes and St. Louis and Gorton here has helped that a great deal. You know, it's the chances of that happening have gone up considerably, in my opinion, because of the change in management and the change in coach. So you know, I think the Canadians are not in bad shape. They don't have necessarily a game-breaking blue-chip talent coming in the pipeline on defense, but they have really good depth with you know, those four guys that we just talked about, including Romanov in there. But you know, Romanov, Gooley, Mayu, Harris. You have four guys you have one who's already in the NHL, and you have three other guys who are very likely to play in the NHL. So I think they're in good shape. And yeah, I would agree that they'll probably target a forward. This isn't a very defense-heavy draft in any case, but you know, they do need some forwards in their pipeline. But thanks for the question. And yeah, it's you know, Struble, Norlander, like those. I think that's good depth in terms of defense. But I think they're in a sort of wait and see tier. Like they might make the NHL, they might be able to be a regular in the NHL, but I don't think we know that yet. So let's see. But I got to admit, I'm very intrigued to see Matthias Norlander play on a Martin St. Louis coach team and see what happened. That to me is intriguing. So let's see. But yeah, I think the forward group probably needs a little bit of a refresh, so they'd probably focus on that. Hey, Alex, man, we've reached the end of time here, so I'm gonna end it now. Sorry, I'll do one of these again very soon. I love doing these. Thank you, everyone, for jumping on and asking your questions. It was great fun. And yeah, we'll talk to you soon. Yeah, we'll probably try and do this in another couple of weeks or something. All right. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.